Games in Libraries, August 2010. Hi there, I'm Donald Dennis from the Georgetown County Library System in South Carolina, where I run the Bytes Project Games and Technology program. In this edition, we cover the Changing the Guard on the Games and Libraries podcast. I interview the author of Everyone Plays the Library. Heather Pelham and I talk about integrating games into the Georgetown County Library Hurricane Project. Brian Mayer talks to us about game awards. And Jamie Jaro and I review Witch and Wager's Family.
Well, hi there. Welcome to the Games and Libraries podcast. This is Scott Nicholson, and I am joined by someone else today.
Hi, this is Donald Dennis.
Well, who are you?
Well, I've contributed to the show a couple of times before. I'm the...
Yeah, but what are you doing in my segment? This is where the person who puts the podcast together introduces himself.
Well, I'm moving in to take over.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I'm introducing Donald Dennis here, who's actually going to be taking over the Games and Libraries podcast. He's going to be doing the work on it for the Games and Gaming Members Initiative Group as part of the ALA. And so he's going to be collecting your stuff, assembling the pieces, putting it together, and we'll be thrilled to hear from you. Why don't you tell folks a little bit about who you are?
All right. Well, I'm the Games and Technology Programs Librarian for the Georgetown County Libraries in Georgetown County, South Carolina. And I also have a podcast that some of you may have heard of. It's On Board Games, and it's a podcast, strangely enough, about board games, and I have some fairly nefarious characters who help me out on that. There's a reviewer, an educator down in Australia, and, of course, Scott Nicholson. So we've worked together on podcasts before.
Well, so I'll just get out of your way and let you do your job.
Oh.
I won't be going away forever, folks, that you'll still hear segments from me on this show. But I'll get out of the way and let Don take over.
Well, in fact, I already have my first interview all lined up. I've heard that there's a fairly prestigious worker in the games and library space who's recently released a book. And so, Scott, let's talk about Everyone Plays at the Library.
Well, hi. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's my pleasure. It's been a while since we've heard your voice around these parts.
Yeah, I realize I've been gone for a while, but it's great to be back and talking about the book that just came out a couple weeks ago at the ALA Annual Conference of 2010, published by Information Today.
Is there also a digital version available, or is it just a printed book?
At this point, it's just a printed book. Those are the sort of decisions that, when you work with a publisher, the publisher makes those decisions based upon how they do things. I've actually had a number of people ask if there was a digital version, and as someone who recently got a Kindle and is getting to know the enemy, it is interesting to wonder if that will come out. But that's a thing for folks out there who haven't written anything. It's just like when you publish a game, when you write a book, a lot of those sort of decisions are now taken out of your hands.
Excellent. Well, I mean, that's good to know, because as young as what we're talking about, the show is as a consideration that a living document of some sort would be a very handy thing to have. But let's talk more about what you wrote in Everyone Plays at the Library.
Well, this book got started when I taught my class in the last summer. I did a class via YouTube on games and libraries, and that's still all available. You can go and watch. It's 30 videos that I released over the month of June, one every day. And as I explored the topic with the class and then also did workshops throughout the next year, I used that as the basic structure for the book. But in the book, I elaborate a lot more on the topics that were covered in the class. And that's the advantage of the book, is it forces you to think through everything systematically and creates a very easily flippable and reviewable format for people to go back and refer to. So the book, it starts with the concept that you don't need to know anything about gaming in order to approach this book. And it starts with you thinking about your library's goals and missions, why your library exists. Once you think about that, then you think about, the book leads you through how to think about the missions for having gaming in your library. And I present that with some data, because over the last few years, I've done a lot of surveys, and I understand a lot of models that are out there. What I've found over the years is the libraries that struggle to do gaming in their library are those programs that go straight to the game. They say, we want to do a World of Warcraft program. We want to do a chess program. But they don't think about how that is tying into the library's mission. And that can cause trouble when it comes time to justify why it is you have the program. And so the book is really about starting with your library's mission, developing missions for the gaming program. And then I present an original conceptual model to help people think about games. And what I've done is I've created five archetypes that group all of gaming into one of five types of game experiences. Part of what I'm focusing on is the concept of the game experience. That is not just putting a game down, but it's actually the game plus the players that are involved plus the context in which the game is taking place. Then the majority of the book is actually focused on each of the five gaming experiences where I talk about it, and then I present about 100 different reviews for board games, card games, video games, computer games, role-playing games, things like that, to help you then select specific games based upon the game experience. I then talk about how to actually run and facilitate the games and different models to do that, and then how to assess what you've done back to those goals that you set. And the idea is that if you go through this process, starting with the goals of the library, developing goals for the program from that, selecting games that support those goals, and assessing to make sure the games are meeting those goals, you now have a very justifiable gaming program. If someone says, why are you doing this? You can answer that question with data. And that's what is important if you're seeking to continue to get funding for your programs.
Sounds like you've talked about this a time or two before.
I have. I've been at this for a little while.
You've got some interesting deeper level thought about what kinds of programs you're putting together, but the planning and facilitating as well as the evaluating parts, even if you knew what you were going to do already or what kind of programs you wanted to do, you could read those segments of the book just to get yourself started. A lot of what you put in there, very interesting material. If you want to have more of a long-term enduring, we want a program and here's how we need to focus some of what we're doing at the library, then you've got some really good stuff that it's pretty meaty. Do you think that having this much information is going to put barriers between people and saying, hey, we want to start something? Or, you know, where does this fall in the, gosh, we want to do a game program, when should we read this book?
Well, I do have to, as part of that, I have to say that in my full-time job, I'm a professor. And so part of this is thinking about this book can be used as a textbook for library school classes. So for people that want that more, some conceptual work, some more meat in a book, you're going to find it with this. That said, I also helped one of the local public libraries get a gaming program going and have also worked with other libraries as they started. So a lot of that from the facilitation chapter has come from getting my hands dirty, actually running these sort of programs, running these things, setting them up, and then helping them do the assessment and seeing what questions were useful, what questions were not useful. So it's really a good combination of theory and practice. So for folks out there who went through their library science program, you're going to feel this book fits that slightly deeper look at the topic. That said, I've tried to write it at a level that anyone who is even brand new to gaming can get into it and come away with some solid ideas. I didn't want something that started with an assumption that you already understand certain games. I wanted to empower someone so that even if you didn't like the games that I talked about in the book, because you came out of this conceptual space, you could go to your local game store and you say, hey, I really need a game that's going to work for 12 to 16-year-olds that's going to allow them to explore knowledge of topics or that is customizable, or it'll help you figure out what questions you should ask when you go to your local game store in order to come away with a game that's going to be useful.
Absolutely, absolutely. So since it's been out for, almost a month at this point?
Just a couple weeks.
A couple of weeks?
Yeah.
How's the response been?
I think it's a little too early to know. You know, at this point, they're sending out review copies. They're trying to get some of the buzz going. And so, there are people who have been excited about it. I've gotten good feedback from people who have worked through the book. I think what it does different than the other books that are on the market is that sort of conceptual, more meaty components. And the advantage of having something conceptual, and this is where the idea of having it in book form comes into play, having something more conceptual means that once you work your way through it, you have a mental framework, and you can then look at new games that come out and decide where it fits in that framework. If I didn't have the framework and I just said, here's a bunch of games that you could go out and try, well, okay, this new game comes down the pipeline, you may not feel comfortable saying, well, I don't know how to analyze this new game. I don't know where it should fit. Should it be something I look at? But And this is the same concept of how we teach everything. You know, if we teach some basic concepts and theories with some cases to help you apply them, then you're able to take that and move on from this point forward. You don't need me to continue to evaluate each game that comes out. You can look at it and say, oh, okay, I now know this game fits in this category, therefore I'd use it for these purposes. And that's what I want to empower people to do.
That sounds almost like a good eat sort of way.
Well, Alton Brown has been a personal hero of mine for many of the things I do. And it's also what we do in library school. That's the idea, is you want to empower people to give them the theories and the concepts so they can then go out and continue to function as a professional.
Well, thank you very much for stopping in to talk with us about Everyone Plays at the Library. I will probably be reading through this book over and over again, you know, over the course of the year, so that we can... you know, finish up this last year of the grant with grace and style.
All right, sounds good, and I look forward to hearing your comments on it.
This is Donald Dennis, and I'm here today with
Heather Pelham,
and we're going to be talking about her use of games in a special project at the Georgetown County Libraries. It's the Hurricane Project. Tell us a little bit about that, and then we'll get into the games.
Okay, the Hurricane Project is something that the library decided to do a year and a half ago, because we're almost done, although I think that our gaming portion may go on forever. It's really popular. But we have a lot of facets to it. We do interviews with folks who survived a hurricane. We've created public service announcements that run on local cable channels and will forever, every hurricane season. And we do a lot of workshops. We do hurricane safety workshops and, you know, things about, you know, making your home safer, keeping your pets safe. But we also do Web 2.0 workshops with county employees to help them get the word out if there is a disaster or even when there isn't. Web 2.0 and social media is, you know, just a great way for to have like a Facebook page talking about a county program. I know our Parks and Recreation Department uses it all the time.
Right.
And then we also do workshops with county residents, teaching them things like PhotoStory 3 and Facebook, trying to get them into the 21st century as well, making sure everybody's on top of these things.
Right. Excellent. All of these are cool. However, this is the Games and Libraries podcast. So tell us a little bit about how you've used games in the Hurricane Project.
Okay. I do believe that the gaming component has been our most popular component. It started pretty big and just kept getting bigger. So we use an online game. It's a disaster game where kids actually get to create this indestructible city and then hit it with a natural disaster. And although we are the Hurricane Project, they can also hit it with a tsunami or a wildfire or an earthquake. So lots of choices.
Now, did you create this game?
We didn't. This was created by the United Nations, and kids are playing it all over the world as we speak.
Is there any cost to use it?
No.
So libraries can use it for free for other programs that they have.
Absolutely. Very easy to put on your computer. Very easy.
Wonderful. How do you run your events? Why is this important to the Hurricane Project? What good is it to the people who come in and play?
Well, one of our big goals was to make sure we get not only every corner of the county, but also every age involved, because, you know, there is some time in between the big hurricanes, thank God, but... You forget what's going to happen, and it's really nice to be able to have another generation coming up who knows a little bit about what's going to happen and how to get ready for it. And this is just, you know, keeping kids a little more mindful of what a hurricane really is and some of the things you can do to get ready.
Right. And I know that my son, when we moved down to hurricane country, he was, well, deathly afraid of the idea that we'd be living on the coast and be hit by hurricane. And after he played through the Stop Disasters game a few times, he now has a knowledge, instead of generating panic, which was my fear that he'd be saying, oh my gosh, I see how much damage, how many people died, is that he understands that there are things that can be done and the value of an early warning system, and that he doesn't have to come and ask me every 10 minutes, is this storm turning into a hurricane? How do you know that this is having, I mean, I've got my own evidence, but how do you know that it had impact on the kids?
Well, I think one of the cutest ways that we noticed it was that we've done exit interviews with them. Every couple of disaster nights, we do these exit interviews. And they sound like little FEMA engineers. They're so cute. They sit there, you know, we asked them, did you have fun? And what did you like about the game? What didn't you like? And they were pretty basic kid answers. These are kids who are like 7 to 14.
Right. Did you learn anything?
Yeah.
Like,
No, I don't. But the big thing is we would have at least two of them being, we would talk to two of them at a time and we'd say, so what were your game strategies? And they would start talking about break walls and dunes and reinforcing and putting up early warning systems and equipping the hospital. And just, they sounded like little FEMA engineers. They were so cute. They were so ready for this.
So where they didn't see that they were learning anything, you talk to them on their level about game strategy, mm-hmm. then all of a sudden, all this information comes out.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's actually good to know, because when I was asking Daniel, well, so what did you learn from the game? He's like, nothing. You know, 10-year-old kid, you know, right. sometimes isn't forthcoming about learning.
He's, how did you win?
That's right.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's very exciting. Now, how did you come to the idea of using this game as part of your program?
This was actually the library director here just loves exploring. He's a huge technophile. He loves, you know, exploring the internet, seeing what the latest is. He came across this game and emailed me and he said, you have to check this out. I'm addicted to it. I can't stop playing it. I'm going to get fired. So I went on, and darn if he wasn't right. It's really, you know, I'm looking going, well, the graphics aren't anything. It's not like, you know, one of these really fancy game system games. But it's addictive. You start playing it, you can't stop. You're so worried about making sure everybody's safe and getting the high score and making sure you're the town manager and you don't want to get fired. So, yeah, it's a lot of fun.
And along those lines, when you push that button to see how your sites get destroyed or whether your city lives through it, it gives you a score.
Mm-hmm.
And you use that as part of what you're doing.
We do. We run our disaster nights as sort of a tournament. And the top three players get the top three placing players get a big prize, and then everybody gets some prize because everybody likes to get a prize.
Well, it sounds like you found a great way to work games into programs that aren't about games. And I'd suggest that any library could do this for any other kind of public outreach that you're working for. Not only are there video games like this, but there are some board games that you could use if you're doing disasters. Mayfair has Ablaze, which is about fighting forest fires or fighting brush fires. And there's another game, Terra, by Bruno Ferduti, which talks about the globe being under stress. And we pulled those out previously on game nights when we had the table space available for it. So I think that you can find, as librarians, an excuse to use games as part of another program without calling it a gaming program. So that's it. And so, Heather, thank you very much.
No problem.
And I appreciate you for coming on the podcast.
Sure.
World, we have a lot of awards. We have the Newbery, the Caldecott, the Prince, and numerous others. Now, having a lot of awards isn't a bad thing. There's a lot of books out there, and awards help us recognize and select quality literature and books for our libraries. There are game awards as well, too. More specifically, I'm going to talk about board game awards. There is the Spiel des Jahres, which has been around for about 30 years. It started in 1978, and the goal of the Spiel des Jahres is to recognize and promote top-quality games that are published and come out in Germany. And while this focuses on games that have come out in Germany, really it's a benchmark and a standard for board gaming across the entire globe. Now, the award is given out by a jury of board game critics. They look at games that have come out in the past 12 months, and they're family-style games, so we're not talking the complex, in-depth, marathon-level games, but more accessible games that the whole family can sit down and enjoy. That's a great match for libraries. We can have specialized groups that focus on those more in-depth, complicated game experiences, but if we're looking for some great game resources that are going to reach out to a wide variety, then family-style games are definitely going to be a good fit. There's also the Kinderspiel des Jahres, which looks at the best children's game. That's been out a little bit less time, and it came out about 1989. The jury who gives out the awards also puts out a list of recommended games that have come out as well, too. Other games that, though they didn't make the list, are highly recommended and should be considered as well, too. And occasionally, they will give out special prizes for games that don't quite fit the mold of what a Spiel des Jahres game is, but definitely should be considered for some special recognition. Usually when they're looking at games, what are they looking at? They're looking at the idea of the game and the originality behind it. Is there something new here, or have we seen this all before? How clear are the rules? How is it presented? How beautiful of a game is it? The bits, the quality, the components, the arts. How unique and sophisticated are the mechanics or the way that you play the game? As well as the game designer as well, too. A lot of times in the Oscars, someone gets an Oscar because it was their time. They've done quality work and they've been passed over in the past. Sometimes that comes into play in the Spiel des Jahres as well for some of the game designers. So with the Spiel des Jahres, the Kinderspiel des Jahres, the recommended list, and the special awards, what we have for libraries is a wonderful list of games, a starting place that you can look back over the past if you're new to looking at incorporating board games into your library and say, well, what have been the top quality family-style games that have been out over the last 20 to 30 years? And so you have this wonderful list. Now, some of the older ones are going to be hard to find, they're out of print, but looking at the past 5 to 10 years, you've got a great selection of games. This last year, the award was just announced on the 28th of June, Dixit was announced the winner. And Dixit is a fantastic game that is produced by Asmodee Editions here in the U.S., and Dixit is a card game, and in Dixit what you have is you have a hand of cards that you're dealt, and they have these beautiful, lush images on them. They're like little surrealistic paintings, each and every one, and the art is really what makes this game. So you have a hand of cards, and the mechanic or the way that you play the game is very similar to apples to apples. So when you're introducing this in your library, you're going to have a good reference point for teaching new people this game, because if they have some familiarity with how you play apples to apples, that's going to help them get into Dixit. So playing Dixit, everybody has a hand of these cards with these beautiful images on it, and one person is going to start and they're going to tell a little story. Really what they're doing is they're coming up with a word or a phrase, a sentence, a title, something that elicits or connects with the image on their card. They're going to say that, and they're going to put their card face down. Now, everybody else is going to look at their card, and they're going to look at their images, and they're going to try and pick out a card that matches with that sentence, idea, phrase that was said by the original person. They're going to put it face down. They're all going to go in the center, get mixed up, and flipped up, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, depending on how many people are playing, in a row. Everyone else who's playing, besides the person that came up with the phrase or the sentence, is going to try and look at all of those cards and pick out which one was the original card by the person who created the phrase. Now, everybody else will know at least one of the cards, the card that they put down, but they won't know the other ones there. So there's some great kind of empathy, knowing your neighbor type skills. What do I know about the person who created the phrase or sentence, and which card do I think they would have put down? There's also some wonderful interpretation of imagery, where you're looking at these cards, and whether you're creating the phrase or sentence, or you're trying to figure out or read the cards on the table, you're interpreting these images. And because they're so sophisticated and so surreal, there's a lot of ways that you can interpret it, which becomes very interesting, how one person looks at an image versus another person. Now, the twist or the rub with this game, which makes it even more engaging, is that the person that creates the phrase or creates the sentence has some limitations. They don't want everybody or nobody to figure it out. If they do, if nobody figures it out because it was too obscure, then that person who created the phrase isn't going to get any points and everybody else does. Similarly, if everybody figures it out, then the person that creates the phrase, again, is not going to get any points, and everybody is. So when you're creating or coming up with this sentence, this idea, it needs to be somewhere in the middle. And that's an interesting thing to try and do, to try and look at the table, figure out what's going to connect with some people, but not everybody. So I highly recommend checking this game out. It's a wonderful game to start with if you're looking at introducing games to your library, or it's definitely one to add to your collection if you already do. That's Dixit by Jean-Louis Robillard. It's put out by Asmodee Editions here in the United States. Check out that and all the past award winners and nominees for the Spiel des Jahres. This is Brian Mayer, Library Gamer, saying keep on gaming and keep on learning.
This is Donald Dennis, and I'm here with
Jamie Giroux.
And we're at the Georgetown Library here in South Carolina. And we're going to talk today about North Star Games' new game. Well, it's kind of an old game, but it's a new version of their old game, Wits and Wagers. So we just got this in. They sent it to us. So it's the new family edition of their Wits and Wagers game. And since we have a game program here, and we do family game night every Thursday night, we thought we'd break it out, take a look at it, and see how it played. We're a big fan of the original series, right? We've brought out Wits and Wagers for some of our game days.
Yes, we had a National Games Day. We actually brought it out, and we had close to 10 to 12 people gathered around playing it. So we had a lot of fun with the original version. So it's good to see they brought out a family version that everybody can partake in.
And that's a big deal, because our National Games Day was kind of focused around video games. But we also brought out board games as well. And Pictureka had some people playing it, and Wits and Wagers. So it's a good thing. All right, before we get started, this is a North Star Games game made by Dominic Crepuchets. It's for ages 8+. It says 3 to 10 players, but because kids often like to be on teams, you could have, you know, more than 10 players if you really wanted to do teams. 2 minutes to teach. Would you say that's accurate?
It's pretty accurate. It says 2 minutes to teach, 20 minutes to play, and from what we've seen, that's very accurate.
All right. Now, you open up the Wits and Wagers Family Edition, and you notice a few things are missing from the box that were in the original box. What did you notice right away that it didn't have?
The biggest thing, the felt mat is gone. That was one thing I really liked about the original version, and it is gone, replaced with a standard smaller scoreboard.
Right. Now, in the previous editions of Wits and Wagers, one had what was like a giant mouse pad board. You know, it was made out of the same mouse pad spongy material. And then they had another one that was cloth. And it was a neat, eye-catching thing, especially for adults. But it looked like a poker table like in Vegas. For kids or family, the parents aren't necessarily into the gambling aspect, and might be have seen as teaching them the wrong things, teaching the kids the wrong things. So they did away with that this time, and instead you just have the cards that you write your answers on.
Yeah, the cards they're very similar to the original version, and if we look at the back, they all have different colors with icons. Like the green one has a soccer ball, the pink one has flowers, so it is somewhat gender specific. But that's basically how they formatted the cards for this.
Now, what else do they have on the back of these cards?
Oh, meeples. They have our new Wits and Wager icons, the meeples, which ironically for this look like a family. It's a big meeple and a small meeple, so I guess a mother or father and child.
Exactly. The other thing is they've got one card that already has a number on it, and that's the black color. There's not a black meeple in the game, but there is a card that has the big number one on it, so it represents the smallest value. Like in the old version of Wits and Wagers, it'd be from one up to whatever number people would write down. And this one just shows, well, look, there's already the lowest number built in, because people would win Wits and Wagers all the time by always just writing 1, 1, 1, because everybody else was going way over the number. They have a scoreboard in this game, which is kind of like the scoreboard that's in Say Anything. Say Anything is another game from North Star Games, where you would mark off points as you accumulated them. So once again, just like the other one, you have the dry erase markers, and you can write on the cards with them, and you can fill out the scoreboard with them. Now let's talk about the questions. What did you think about the question mix?
There are actually two questions on each card. So they encourage you to do the first question on each card, and then continue through the deck. And as I said, there are less options on each card, so it seems like a smaller pool of questions.
Right, so there's like 300 questions in the game, and you go through the deck once, and then you do the deck a second time, which, you know, when we're at the library, we could be playing the game over and over again with different groups of people, not with the same family all the time. 300 questions will last us a long time. Now, North Star Games has another game expansion out for the original Wits and Wagers game. It's just kind of a deck of cards with new questions. And you can use, if you want to expand this game, you could bring that deck of cards into this no problem. But it is going to have questions that interest adults, as opposed to
like how many color Fruit Loops there are, and I imagine that there's questions about, you know, how many colors are in the crayon family and all that kind of stuff. So we haven't obviously gone through all 300 questions because we kind of just cracked this game open today. Obviously, this game is so closely tied to the original Wits and Wagers. Now, what did you think of it? I mean, what's your final overall opinion on the game?
It achieved its focus. It was directed towards kids or a family board game, and it definitely achieved that while maintaining the original content of the core version.
Right. Well, that's it then. That's our, you know, hot off-the-shelf edition review. I'm Donald Dennis.
And I'm Jamie Giroux.
Thank you for listening.
This is Scott Nicholson here with a brief announcement that just came out. The registration for National Gaming Day 2010 is now open. The first 1,000 libraries register will get a free copy of Wits and Wagers Family. So we'll be talking more about this event as it gets closer, but if you want your library to register, go to ngd.ala.org. That's ngd.ala.org. Go register your library for National Gaming Day 2010. It's going to be on Saturday, November 13th, and the first 1,000 librarians that register will get a free copy of a game. So sign up now. You'll hear more about it later on this podcast.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Games and Libraries podcast. We'd like to hear from you about your ideas about integrating games into library programming. If you've had success or if you've had a catastrophic failure we can all learn from, please record it and send it in to us. You can send any of your ideas, questions, comments, or recordings to donaldgdennis@gmail.com.
The Games and Libraries podcast is part of the Games and Gaming Members Initiative Group. To talk about the topics on this podcast or other topics about gaming and libraries, please visit connect.ala.org/gaming.